Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Welcome to After Work Drinks, your weekly dose of news, pop culture, and Pinot Noir, brought to you by magazine editors and best friends, Isabel Truman and Grace O'Neill.
Hello, everyone.
Hello.
Welcome. Izzy, you're free. You've been liberated by the New Zealand government. How does it feel?
Yeah, so New Zealand's in level two now, and that basically means everything's gone back to normal, everything's open again. Oh, I think bars are the only thing that haven't yet opened, but I think they're opening tonight. So you can literally just go out like normal, but you're supposed to be social distancing still. So when you go into stores, they monitor how many people go in and out. But essentially you can travel again, you can go to restaurants, you can go to cafes, you can see your mates, you can have a party if there's 10 people or less, which I have done now. And
it's so hard for me to imagine, like, it's not even that many people, 10 people, but I'm like, wow, I feel like you've been to Glastonbury.
I know. Yeah, it's funny. I felt exhausted on Thursday, which was the first day we were allowed to see people. And what did I even do? I saw a couple of mates and I just felt so tired afterwards. I just felt zapped of energy. And also I've already started doing that thing where I just overcommit, because obviously I'm in New Zealand, so I can see friends and family for the first time in so long. I haven't seen them in 6 weeks since I've been here. But already I feel like I'm overcommitting to things and kind of stretching myself thin again. And I'm just like, isn't that the one thing that you would just learn after being in a pandemic and being locked inside for so long? You'd think you would learn what your priorities are and that you don't need to be saying yes to everything and you don't need to be always out all the time. But I feel as though I'm kind of slipping back into my old ways.
It's so difficult when you go home as well, because I just feel like the pressure's heightened to see everyone. And it's not that you don't want to see people, but it's kind of that thing of, if you don't see them in this period, then you might not see them for a year or whatever. And it's easy to offend people if you see some people and not other people. So it is kind of a no way out situation.
I know. I just can't feel
like
exhausted.
My mental health requires that I don't see anyone ever again.
That I isolate again.
That's how I know. I feel. I want to isolate every second.
But people keep saying to me, people keep asking how you are, because New Zealand's going back to normal. I saw a bunch of girls today and they're like, how's Grace going? And I was just like, I think she really enjoys just being, just
Grace is thriving. Ask how Grace is going when we get down to level two.
Yeah. Also, it's so funny because everyone in New Zealand calls it our bubble. So you've had a bubble the whole time. And I didn't realize that wasn't a universal thing until recently. So my bubble is who I've been interacting with this whole time. And now you can pop your bubble. And so all these isolation couples are popping their bubble instead of cherry and bussing. Mm.
Right. The post-lockdown buss.
Yeah.
We got sent this, well, we might cut this because I don't know if you'll find it funny or not, but we got sent some beauty products, and one of them was a spray that I thought was like a sleep spray for the pillow, and I've been spraying on my pillow every night and then just been knocked unconscious for like 12 hours. Oh. And I looked at it and it's a buss spray. It's like a sex spray. to create what? Intimacy. Yes, if you look at it, it's like the love spray to
I didn't get that. I mean, obviously I didn't get it. I don't have anyone to to love up. They send it to the person who's in a relationship. I'm going to write them a letter of complaint.
I know, and it just made me laugh so much because it's meant to promote, like, sexual intimacy, and it's just making me dead unconscious for 12 hours every single night because I just thought it was a sleep spray. But, yeah. Anyway, things are much the same here, but I've got a new apartment because I didn't have much to do the last few weeks, so I just started a little project, which was project move into a nicer house for the same price, and it's been a raging success. But I've signed on, Izzy. This is, like, quite chaotic. I've signed on for 3 years.
Yeah, that's crazy.
You can break after 14 months, which is still a really long time. Yep. And I've never seen it before because we can't go inside.
Yes, quite chaotic. Yeah. I mean, this is coming from the girl who, I haven't said this out loud on the podcast before, but who moved into a house, realized they hated it the second they moved in, and then essentially packed up my entire room and moved out and moved back to New Zealand, and then didn't tell them until I was here that I was just not coming back to the house. Like, I paid rent and all that, but I was just like, I'm physically not coming back there ever. Please send me my AirPods immediately. God. And I'd ordered about 15 books on Amazon before I decided I was going home to New Zealand, so they're all there.
Oh, no.
I know.
Yeah. Anyway, so I'm excited about that. And
me too.
That's kind of it. Oh, so I have some good recommendations this week.
Hmm.
First one is I started watching Pose.
Oh, yeah. How is it? You messaged me and said, I think you were supposed to be replying to me about something. And then you were like, I'm so sorry, I've been watching Pose. And then you just said, and then I saw the dots, like you were typing again, and then you just go, Insecure is next, I promise.
Yeah, I was like, I feel guilty saying anything that's not Insecure. But basically, Paris is Burning is one of my favorite movies of all time. It's a documentary about the drag ball culture of New York in the 70s and 80s. Which all started there. And it's obviously having a real moment right now because that show is coming out soon with Jamila Jamil, which is a ballroom competition, like a ballroom reality show. Mm. RuPaul's Drag Race is like a lot of their structure is based around it. And then Pose, which is Ryan Murphy just gets a lot done.
He does a lot.
Yeah. A lot. Like, why does he have a show every 45 seconds? It's just crazy.
I know. Everyone's so obsessed with him. Is everyone super obsessed with him because of Glee, or is it just because he does heaps of good stuff? But Glee, and did he do American Horror Story? Is that him?
He did American Glee and then American Horror Story, and then he did The People versus OJ.
Oh, yeah.
And then
The Politician and, like,
Pose, and then The Politician. Yeah, he is fantastic, but
yeah.
I just don't understand how one man can put out so much output. But Pose is a very... because the great thing about Paris is Burning is it's shot in a real kind of handy cam way, and Pose is very slick. But I watched the first couple of episodes and it's just fantastic. I can't believe I haven't watched it before. And that is not what Billy Porter's famous for, but I think that that's when he started to take off
massive
for his role in it. Yeah.
I'm really keen to watch it.
It's really great. And the other thing is on a bit more of a somber note, which is Lynn Shelton, who's a filmmaker and director, most recently directed Little Fires Everywhere, very sadly passed away earlier this week from complications related to COVID, I think. She had a blood disease. And Marc Maron, who hosts WTF, the comedian, did a really beautiful tribute to her on his podcast and just played
her. That's his partner?
Yeah, that's his partner. Sorry, yeah, her partner. So the interview that he plays with her is from 2015, and it's the first time they met. So you hear them meeting for the first time, and she's amazing. And I think at the time he was dating.
So wait, did he interview her in 2015?
He interviewed her in 2015, and then again in 2018 for his podcast, and that's how he met her. Aww. And they'd been dating for the last like year and a half, but had known each other for years. And you can just hear in the interview, it's just really beautiful. Like, he's just so impressed by her, and she's so funny and quick and on the ball, and she's just an amazing person. And it's very sad that it happened, but it's also just a really beautiful like tribute to a very talented woman. So I think that's definitely worth a listen.
That's heartbreaking. I want to cry just thinking about that.
He's recorded it very soon after she died, which
yeah,
I know,
that's what
like,
I was
no
gonna
one
say.
Is in
yeah.
any position to judge like how you grieve. But I almost felt bad listening to it because he's like crying the whole way through, and yeah.
God.
I know.
What would you do if I... Sorry, I can't say this. Should I say it?
I'd replace you in seconds. No, it is funny.
Nothing to see here.
Izzy's gone. Get over it.
Okay, so I have a recommendation, and I watched a film, which is really good, and I'd never heard of it before. It came out last year, and it's called Richard Jewell. And it is about...
I have seen this on buses a lot.
Oh, yeah. Yes. So it is a true story. When the 1996 Olympics were on, a guy, there was a bomb scare at Centennial Park when there was a concert on. And this kind of security guard guy who'd always wanted to be a cop, but he never quite got there. And so he was helping out at the gig or whatever it was. And he saw a bag and he called it in. And then the bomb squad, like the police were basically like, oh, you know, it's just a bag. It's probably just got beer in it. Don't worry about it. And he was like, no, no, no. And called it in. And then the bomb squad got there, and basically he saved so many people's lives. But the bomb was supposed to go off and kill heaps and heaps of people, but it had been like kind of knocked over. So it didn't, I think it killed, I think maybe two people died or something, but it was supposed to be really, really catastrophic. But then the FBI start going after him because they think he actually planted it there. It's crazy. And it's a really good movie, and it has Olivia Wilde in it.
Love.
Yeah. And it's just kind of like a heartfelt, good movie. Directed by Clint Eastwood randomly.
Tell me. Did he do it?
I'm not telling you. But, I mean, no. It's not even, it's, you know he didn't do it right from the start. It's more just okay. The craziness of the story, and then the whole, how the police are targeting him, and then how what the role the media plays in it as well. It's kind of like an Amanda Knox tale.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah, but it's really good. Yeah. And then the only other recommendation I have kind of leads into what we wanted to talk about today, and that is I re-listened to Reni Eddo Lodge's book called Why I'm No Longer Talking to White People About Race. And basically she wrote this book after a blog post she wrote in, I think, 2014 went viral of the same name. And she basically said, this is why I'm no longer talking to white people about race. Shared it on, I think, Twitter, and it went viral. And then she ended up writing a book about it because basically she realized that stopping herself from having the conversation just helped nothing, and that there are a lot of people who want to have the conversation. So she released this book. She's British journalist. And me and Grace both had read the book, I don't know, whenever it came out, a couple of years ago or last year.
2017, I think.
Yeah, and then... my copy's now with my mum in New Zealand, so I'm going to get it back off her. But I wanted to re-listen to it in the wake of all of this, these just horrific stories coming out of the US at the moment. I would highly recommend it to anyone to listen to it. At the start, the first chapter is very much centered around the whole book is centered around Britain and the history of race in Britain. But there's chapters on feminism, the feminism question, and intersectional feminism, questions on white, chapters on white privilege, which was really, really interesting, and chapters on kind of even just the fact she said that when she was 4 years old, she said to her mum, when am I going to turn white? And it was because she was watching TV and all the good people were white and all the bad people were black.
Mm-hmm.
It's just so nuts. And just how you just don't even, you look, everywhere you look is just whitewashed, but until you open your eyes you just don't even think about it. And it's something that we've been trying to work really hard on doing all the time, but it's hard because I think the reason we haven't talked about this on the podcast before is because I have always felt like we don't know what we're talking about because we're two white women who come from a lot of privilege in terms of the countries we were born in, the way we were raised, just everything, just being white, being a white woman. And so I've never known what to say about it.
But this is something we wanted to talk about because there was the Ahmaud Arbery case in America, which was obviously absolutely horrendous. And there was this huge social media movement around it, which actually ended up with the two men who murdered Ahmaud being reprimanded finally after fucking months of no justice. But it kind of put me and Izzy in this position where we were thinking a lot about how to discuss this in a meaningful way that wasn't just, it's so sad or it's so terrible or people are racist, and then kind of leaving it at that. And we realized that in taking the attitude that we weren't the most equipped people to have this conversation, we kind of realized that like a big part of why racism is still such a fucking huge endemic issue is because white people treat it as if it's not our issue to talk about. And I think that there's this attitude that like it's people of color's issue, as opposed to the fact that it's white people created racism, and it's kind of our job to like interrogate how we can break down that structure instead of just constantly asking people of color like to give us fucking instructions about what to do.
I think people just are worried to put their foot in it, and that's the thing. And because you are going to put your foot in it, we're probably going to put our foot in it today because we're all learning. But that's what you have to do to kind of break down these barriers and start having these conversations. And they're going to be uncomfortable, and it's going to make us probably feel quite guilty about our privilege, quite upset that all of this has happened. Because when you start reading into things and when you get really deep, you feel really, really, really sad and angry, I think, that this has happened and that these injustices happen every single day. But it's so much easier to kind of say, well, I don't know what to do, or think because you're a white person, no one wants to hear from you what to do about it. People want to hear from the people who are suffering. Because the thing is, it's literally with feminism. We want men to be our allies, but I also think that hearing a man stand up and say, well, actually, no, hearing a man stand up and say that like women have it shit, this is what's wrong, it would be amazing.
Like, you can't clearly compare racism and sexism, obviously, but there are enough parallels to kind of talk about it a bit through this conversation. But you know, we saw after Me Too men kind of coming out and trying to be allies, and it just, the timing wasn't right, and a lot of them did it very clumsily and clunkily, and it didn't really work out particularly well. And I think that after that, it just seemed that men in positions of power took the attitude of like, I'm just not going to talk about it, instead of being willing to fumble or muddle their way through a difficult or awkward conversation. And I think that that's really been to the detriment of the movement, that men haven't been willing to do that, because I understand that it's easier to just say nothing and not get involved and not try to have the conversation. But you're just adding to the problem by doing that. And I think that we would really appreciate having powerful men have engaging conversations about the way that they can look at and address their own behavior day to day, and encourage other men to do the same, to try and dismantle like a system that benefits them and oppresses women. And I think that that's kind of what we've realized that we need to be doing as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you don't want to be a white savior. The thing with social media and the thing with Ahmaud's murder and the video being shared on social media, it's not enough to just post about him. And you can feel, because you can feel as though you're just jumping on and you're just kind of, like essentially being a white savior or whatever. But then in that particular case, you can see how getting more and more eyeballs on that literally resulted in people being arrested. So social media and sharing these things with people really does make a difference, and it's really important you do that. But I just think that there's so much more that you need to be doing behind the scenes. And essentially what Renee Ito Lodge is saying in her book, you need to do the learning yourself if you care about something. And it's exactly like anything that you care about. You wouldn't just go and ask. We were saying this last week with magazines, and I said this kind of will lead into our topic for next week, is when people come to us and they say, what do I do to get your jobs? Or what do I do to get in your position? And yes, you can ask that question, but only ask that question after you've done the work and after you've figured it out for yourself and after you've tried really hard. And that's basically what Renee Ito Lodge and a lot of other women who I follow are saying. They're just like, if you really care about this cause and you really want to make a difference, then figure it out for yourself. What can help us? Like, we're sick of having to fucking essentially mansplain to you guys what to do. because you want to just feel good and you want to talk to a black person and have a black person say, you know, make you feel better about it, essentially.
Yeah, so Renee Ada Lodge has a podcast as well that she ran in conjunction with the book's release, and there was a great episode that is called The Big Question, I think. And it's basically about, like, the emotional labor that we put on people of color to, like, explain to us how to not be racist, basically. And yeah. And there's another episode that was amazing that she, what did she call it? Like, white women's tears are racist or something. But she was saying how she was doing a book reading, and she was reading a troubling part of the book about something to do with race-related issue in the United Kingdom, and that a white woman just burst into tears in the crowd, and how there's a temptation when we hear about these things like Ahmaud Arbery and police brutality and the fact that people of color are just hugely overrepresented in death rates for COVID-19, the fact that there have been a huge like spike in hate crimes against Chinese people since COVID broke out, just endless things. But I think that the temptation is to cry or say I'm so sad, or kind of bring it back to how it's making you feel, and the idea being that if you showcase the fact that you think it's terrible and it's made you really upset, that that's like, it's like virtue signaling the fact that you are not a racist, basically. Yeah. And that it's, even though you probably have really great intentions because you are shocked by something and upset by something, you're kind of just taking this conversation back to yourself, which is almost the whole problem to begin with. So it's kind of just about like shifting the narrative away from this is making me upset to what can I do? And then the question of what can I do, I think, is asked of people of color all the time. And again, it's well-intentioned, but there is no blanket answer, unfortunately, of like how to solve racism. And Renee Ada Lodge was saying that whenever she's asked that question, she's kind of like, I don't know your life. I don't know the things that you can do in your life to challenge racism, because I don't know much about you. Like, only you can know the things that you can do day to day that can challenge that system.
I think that another massive thing is no one thinks that the conversation is about them. So we could very easily be like, well, I'm not racist because I don't have any bad feelings towards people of color. I want them to be equal to me in every way. But that's not the point. It's because so basically it's like every white person essentially feels like the conversation isn't about them. That mm-hmm. we feel exempt from it somehow, but we're not exempt from it because the privilege is just seeped into us from so many years that it's going to take so, so, so long to unlearn all of these ways that we are just biased without even realizing it. It's literally, once you open your eyes, I feel, and this happens to me all, I think that a huge thing for me anyway is revisiting these books and revisiting these articles constantly, because then you can just slip back into your old, not your old way of thinking, but slip back into being complacent and not challenging things. And so I will see now when you think about it, I'll literally look on the TV and be like, holy shit, everyone's white. I'll see a new movie poster, holy shit, everyone's white. I'll look on a bookshelf, every author is white, everywhere I look is white. And that's how you should think, because that's exactly how we think as women when we see a room full of men. You know, like, because we're women and that's, we're a minority in that sense, we are so, our eyes are so wide open to the fact that when there's men around, or the fact that we get paid less than men, or the fact that, you know, the sexism exists and is so rampant, but we, because we're white, we just don't, it's not actively at the forefront of our minds, which it needs to be. I think that's a huge thing for me. And also, a lot of people of color say essentially that there's two categories. So you're either racist or you're anti-racist, and essentially anti-racist is people who are actively being allies, actively challenging people, actively donating, actively attending marches, actively supporting the work of black people, doing things behind the scenes, And if you're not doing that in your day-to-day life, then you fall into, like, the racist category, essentially.
I think the big problem is that the way we've been conditioned to understand race is that the world is split into racists almost as a noun, where it's like the people in Charlottesville or white supremacists or people who hold very extreme, very hateful, very obviously bigoted ideals. So when you think of what a racist is, it's so far removed from what the average everyday liberal, left-leaning, middle-class educated white person sees themselves as, that they feel like they can wipe their hands off the racism question because they're like, well, I'm not that, therefore I am not a racist, therefore I can't hold racist beliefs. And I think that this is where we fall into such a difficult and complicated trap, because we see racism as such a narrow definition of, like, active racial hatred, we get very, very, very defensive when things that we do or say are framed as being racist, because we automatically jump to a racist is a immoral, terrible human whose ideologies are so separate from mine. And then that's where this kind of white fragility question comes in. So this book, White Fragility by Robin DiAngelo, is something I've been reading in preparation for this episode. And she just says, like, if you take a really, really narrow definition of racism, okay, yeah, you're probably not racist because you're taking the most narrow definition of it. If you're willing to kind of take yourself out of the equation and make it less about you for a moment and look at the ways that you kind of unwittingly feed into racist structures day to day and are willing to kind of take your own emotions out of it, then you'll actually be much more of a powerful ally because you're willing to actually look at things that you're doing each day that are having an impact on people of color that perhaps you just don't want to address or deal with because you don't want to be untangling in your brain the idea that perhaps you could be doing bad things without even realizing them.
Yeah, and also another huge thing that I've a huge point that I've come across a number of times is people who kind of use the color blindness thing where they say, I don't see color, we're all human, we're all part of the human race, I just don't even notice, like, it doesn't even matter to me if you're black or white. And it's like, that just argument isn't valid. It would literally be like a man saying to us, well, it doesn't matter that you're a woman, I just see us all as the same, because it'd be like, okay, you might see us all as the same, but we're literally not, we don't get the same privileges as you. So it's just a stupid argument because it's just basically saying, okay, well, I just don't see the problem.
Yeah, and you're much more likely not to see the problem when you're the one benefiting from the system.
Yeah.
You know? Like, it's very easy not to see it if you're not being actively discriminated against day to day.
Yeah.
Like, of course you don't see it then. It's also, I think, that kind of speaks to the question of the fact that we tend to treat white as default and other races and other cultures as variations from the default.
I know.
And it's kind of this thing where you'll see people say a lot, you know, oh, I don't have any culture, or I don't have any race, I'm just white, I don't know. And it's this idea that that is standard and other things are deviations from that. And that has, like, such a fucking huge impact on the way that everyone walks through the world. Because if you have the privilege of not actively thinking about your skin color, it doesn't, this is the thing that we've said a billion times, but it doesn't mean that you don't have any other problems or you have no other obstacles or hurdles that make your life difficult. It just means that you don't have this one massive hurdle that a huge amount of other people in the world have to face.
Yeah, and in that book, White Fragility, she says, to be perceived as an individual, not to be associated with anything negative because of your skin color, is a privilege largely afforded to white people. Although most school shooters, domestic terrorists, and rapists in the United States are white, it's rare to see a white man on the street reduced to a stereotype.
Yeah, that's a crazy thing as well in our reading. And we read a bunch of amazing stuff on this topic that we'll put all of it in the notes. But just this idea of, like, the angry, threatening, violent black male that's been perpetuated through a huge amount of pop culture, when we just know, like, intellectually know that all of the faces of male violence that we see in terms of, like you say, mass shootings, serial killers, serial rapists, notorious violent men through history, are overwhelmingly represented by white men. And that kind of division that we have as a culture is insane.
Basically, what a lot of the people whose work we were reading, and yeah, as Grace said, we'll put it all in the show notes, but basically they're saying that you need to take ownership of your own education when it comes to race. So there's no kind of simplified answer about it, but it's basically thinking actively daily about your privilege and then what you consume and who created that and who's getting paid for it and what voices are you consuming and supporting? Who are you following on Instagram and whose articles are you reading and whose movies are you seeing and what causes are you supporting and who's getting paid for the products you purchase? And I think that's something that all of us can learn a lot from, and all of us can really make changes to help people. And this is the only way, like, if we don't have these conversations, which might be clunky and might be uncomfortable, and maybe we are saying things that might be not perfect, then at least hopefully some of our listeners will go out and want to do that.
And I think so, just this is just one point I wanted to make quickly, which I think is like really, really interesting. And it's about kind of questioning the way that we frame and phrase like history and our narratives about the way that society has progressed. And an example I'll use is in the book White Fragility, she talks about Jackie Robinson, who was the first African-American major league baseball player in the United States. And she says that the way that that is framed in popular culture is this person was so incredible and so talented that he pushed through a system of oppression and was finally allowed to play. And she said the problem with that is it kind of insinuates that never before did a talented enough African-American baseball player exist that was worthy of playing with white players. She was like, it should be phrased that Jackie Robinson was the first baseball player that white people allowed to play in the Major League Baseball tournament. And it's how we talk about women when we talk about voting. It's like women gained the vote or earned the vote in the 1920s and women of color got the vote in 1964 instead of saying men allowed women to vote in 1920s. Men allowed white women to vote in the 1920s and then men allowed white and then white people allowed women of color to vote in the 1960s. Like the way we phrase it is so important.
Yeah, that's so true.
We kind of take out the responsibility of the oppressing party when we retell these stories.
I had no idea women of color weren't allowed to vote until the 1960s. That's crazy.
Yeah, we say women got the vote in the 20s and it's women got the vote in the 20s. But this is all these things. History is just the way we tell these stories over time are so important in shaping our understanding of things. And if you grow up in a very homogenous, very white, middle-class suburb in Australia and then you attend a very white, very homogenized school, the only introduction you have to people of color is through popular culture, you know? So you're understanding a whole group of people from really problematic, reduced stereotypes from a very, very young age. And it's just informing the way that you approach the people that you meet from then on. And this is why, like, we talk till we're blue in the face about representation in, like, the film industry and in the fashion industry. This is why it's so important.
So that actually reminds me, I'm reading Clementine Ford's book, Fight Like a Girl. And in one part, she references inequality, and she talks about Lupita Nyong'o's speech at the 2015 Black Woman in Hollywood Awards. So I went to YouTube and looked it up, and it is essentially exactly what you're saying with representation, about how she, when she was little, there was no one that looked like her. She never basically thought she'd ever be able to be an actress or be on screens. So we're going to play a little bit of it here.
I received a letter from a girl, and I'd like to share just a small part of it with you. Dear Lupita, it reads, I think you're really lucky to be this black, but yet this successful in Hollywood overnight. I was just about to buy Densha's whitenicious cream to lighten my skin when you appeared on the world map and saved me. My heart bled a little when I read those words. I could never have guessed that my first job out of school would be so powerful in and of itself. I remember a time when I too felt unbeautiful. I put on the TV and only saw pale skin. I got teased and taunted about my night-shaded skin. And my one prayer to God, the miracle worker, was that I would wake up lighter-skinned. The morning would come and I would be so excited about seeing my new skin that I would refuse to look down at myself until I was in front of a mirror because I wanted to see my fair face first. And every day I experienced the same disappointment of being just as dark as I had been the day before. I tried to negotiate with God. I told him I would stop stealing sugar cubes at night if he gave me what I wanted. I would listen to my mother's every word, sitting right there, and never lose my school sweater again if he just made me a little lighter. But I guess God was unimpressed with my bargaining chips because he never listened. And when I was a teenager, my self-hate grew worse. As you can imagine, happens with adolescents. My mother reminded me often that she thought I was beautiful. But that was no consolation. She's my mother. Of course she's supposed to think I'm beautiful. And then Alek Wek came on the international scene. A celebrated model. She was dark as night. She was on all the runways and in every magazine, and everyone was talking about how beautiful she was. Even Oprah called her beautiful. And that made it a fact. I couldn't believe that people were embracing a woman who looked so much like me as beautiful. My complexion had always been an obstacle to overcome, and all of a sudden, Oprah was telling me it wasn't. It was perplexing, and I wanted to reject it because I had begun to enjoy the seduction of inadequacy. But a flower couldn't help but bloom inside me. When I saw Alek, I inadvertently saw a reflection of myself that I could not deny. Now, I had a spring in my step because I felt more seen, more appreciated by the faraway gatekeepers of beauty. But around me, the preference for light skin prevailed. To the beholders that I thought mattered, I was still unbeautiful. And my mother again would say to me, "You can't eat beauty. It doesn't feed you." And these words played and bothered me. I didn't really understand them until finally I realized that beauty was not a thing that I could acquire or consume. It was something that I just had to be.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I also wanted to read out a Instagram post by a British journalist called Gina Martin, who wrote last week, "Sure, I find myself often so fucking ashamed to be white. I'm ashamed of our history. I'm ashamed of our nationalism. I'm ashamed that racism and hate-driven ideologies were the most lethal of all domestic extremist movements over the last 20 years. And most of all, I'm ashamed of our apathy, of our it's so awful and our moving on. How we will say we're shocked but not call someone out in conversation. How we're not reading the books, listening to people. How we're not willing to do the actual learning, the anti-racism work. So I'm asking you to start now. It can feel daunting or it may feel difficult to call casual racism out. But of course it does if you've not started. Read about it more, listen more, and you'll gain the language. Like everything, you gain the confidence if you persist. We as white allies have to be as organized and committed as white supremacists are. That's the only way we'll win. I know we can do more. I know I can, and so can you." Yeah, and the thing is it's, I guess, you could kind of think that there's nothing really that you could do to help. But there is so much we could do to help. Like, I didn't even know this until, I mean, I actually read the statistic a while ago, but I was reading it again. It popped up again when I was reading, doing all this reading for this episode, that black women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die in pregnancy than white women. And that is not because there is anything different about their bodies at all. 3 times more likely to die, and it's because of racial disparities, lack of access, and poor quality of care, which are leading factors among women at lower socioeconomic levels. And that this Harvard professor said that there's a bigger problem. And she said, basically, black women are undervalued. They're not monitored as carefully as white women are. When they do present with symptoms, often they're dismissed. And that even happened with Serena Williams. Her doctor dismissed her concerns and she almost died. And same with Beyonce.
It's so insane.
It's just so, and also I was reading another article on The Atlantic I think it was the Atlantic, and I got to the end, and the next article at the bottom was about how Trump basically cared about the coronavirus when it first hit America, because when it first hit America, it was hitting people really close to him were getting coronavirus, you know, like really, you know, Justin Trudeau's wife had it, and people who were at the same kind of state dinner as him had it. He had to get tested for it. So straight away he was like, oh God, this is going to impact really wealthy people and friends of mine and people I know might die. And he took action, or he started to take action. On April 7th, major outlets began reporting that preliminary data showed that Black and Latino Americans were being disproportionately felled by the coronavirus. And then basically Trump's cabinet were saying, and like the Fox News were saying, that the coronavirus hadn't been the disaster that they feared, and it hadn't turned out to be as dangerous as they thought. And the nationwide death toll that day was 13,000 people. And now it's over 90,000. So basically this author was saying that that what he calls it is our racial contract, which deems certain lives of greater value than others, which is exactly what it is with that statistic about women dying in childbirth, is that we value white people's lives over people of colors, which is just absolutely crazy.
Yeah, and that's like the whole conversation about white supremacy. Like, it's just, I was talking to Zach about it, and I was saying that we live in a white supremacist culture, in the sense that we just see statistically that white lives are just valued so much higher than people of colour's lives, and yet it's seen as like quite extreme loaded political language to talk that way. And I think this is part of the problem, is like language that we use that makes it really hard to call this system what it is without sounding like you're being dramatic or extreme. Like it's almost, I read a really great analogy that said racism has almost adapted in this virus-like way to keep itself alive, where, okay, things that were accepted, discourse and language in the 50s, are no longer accepted, but it doesn't mean that those feelings have gone away. They've just shifted into like a more sophisticated, understated form that is much harder to extract, you know, because we don't really have the language to call it what it is, or if we do, it's seen as the language as being too extreme or over the top. And I think that's a big part of it.
And a part of the problem is people not wanting to be uncomfortable. I mean, the other day, I had a situation with a friend where she just said literally something casually racist that she would never have expected me to call her out on. And it was really awkward because I had to stop. Like, we were just having a normal, chill conversation about basically suburbs in London. And she just said something racist. And then I had to stop and say, that's really inappropriate that you're saying that. And then we had to have this weird conversation. And it is uncomfortable. But basically, essentially everything that I'm reading is saying, if you're not uncomfortable, you're not listening. And if you're not uncomfortable, then you're contributing to the problem. It's like those tiny little things.
And those are the, like we were just saying about how racism has become sophisticated and adapted into this socially acceptable way of saying it. That is the way that we express racist sentiments now. It's not overt. It's I don't want to live in a certain area. Urban. Is this neighborhood a good neighborhood or a bad neighborhood? Is this, all of these kind of quiet, subtle insinuations, which mean the exact same thing that they meant in the 50s. Mm-hmm. We're just using a different vocabulary to describe it. There's a line, there's a distance between understanding why it is that you are that way and act that way. Understanding the reason is really important, but it doesn't provide a justification, you know, like that's the line. You can understand that you have been brought up in a culture that has trained you to see people this way. So in that sense, it's not your fault, the culture that you're born into. What becomes your fault is when you become aware of that culture and refuse to interrogate it and do something about it.
Mm, yeah. And people kind of people getting angry when there's kind of quotas for people of color or minority groups. And it's like, you know, people saying that there was this thing my sister was telling me, because she's studying med, and she said that this father of a kid who didn't get into med school is taking like the university to court or something, because they let Māori and Pacific Island students a certain quota in per year. And he's saying that that shouldn't be a thing and it should just be on grades. And my sister was basically like, dude, if your fucking son had the grades, he would have gotten in. It's not like, It's just so insane. And also the reason that they have these quotas is because there's been a power imbalance for so long that you need to even the playing field out. It's not...
If there was equality, we wouldn't have to have these structures in place to achieve equality.
Yeah. And it's only there until everything's even. And then it's just, it won't be anymore.
And this parlays kind of into a little interview that we want to play here, which is basically that we had been talking about this conversation for a while and doing a lot of reading and a lot of research and planning for this episode. And then I posted to the After Work Drinks Instagram a post celebrating Chrissy Teigen in the wake of the kind of Alison Roman debacle. I didn't know that much about it, but I just thought the way that Chrissy Teigen handled it was so kind of graceful and polished and nuanced and amazing, and really wanted to celebrate that.
Do you want to maybe explain a little bit about it? Because I still to this day have no idea what happened, and I think a lot of people don't. I think Alison Roman did an interview with someone, right? And then she basically said Marie Kondo and Chrissy Teigen churn out heaps of content or something.
Yeah, so Alison Roman, who's someone I'm not like hugely acquainted with, but was one of those cult Bon Appetit editors and now has a column with the New York Times and is a hugely popular kind of celebrity Instagram chef, did an interview with the New Consumer talking about how she's basically going to take this huge following she has and turn it into a kind of monetized empire, and basically whose path she's going to follow and what her plans are and whatnot. And they asked her about what her plans are in terms of expansion, and the interviewer kind of directly led her with is it going to be a group type of thing? And Alison missed that ball that was thrown her way and basically took aim at Chrissy Teigen and Marie Kondo, kind of name checking them as careers that she didn't want to emulate because Chrissy Teigen had done a line with Target, using some pretty like offensive kind of language, saying that her work was like a content farm and that because she'd done a line with Target, she didn't really respect her career. And then she kind of name dropped Marie Kondo as well, which didn't really make sense in the context of what she was talking about. But people were obviously very quick to highlight the fact that the two women that she had decided to go after were women of color in an industry that's kind of very much dominated by the like Gwyneth Paltrow, Martha Stewart, like archetypal white woman. And she apologized, and Chrissy Teigen kind of responded to her apology. And my attitude had been, because I didn't know so much about it and should have read more about it before I posted it, was that Alison had made some misguided comments. The internet had highlighted why they were offensive. She had taken time to look introspectively and apologize.
The way she apologized as well was saying, I don't know why I felt the need to tear down other women to make myself feel bigger. It came from an insecurity. I'm really sorry. I'm working on this. This is my problem, not theirs. Kind of, you know, really taking ownership for that side of things. So I think that's why you were like, well, this is great. She's realized that she was tearing other women down for no reason. And then Chrissy has come back and said, that's okay. We're all learning as like carry on kind of thing. Right.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And that I just thought it was like a great example of someone taking on negative feedback, but it was very much looked at through the perspective of like a purely feminist lens of, you know, we love to jump on when women are fighting with each other and tend to be very quiet when women actually make amends and make peace with each other and kind of wanting to switch up that narrative. But one of our amazing listeners, Crystal, who is an author and a writer, kind of jumped in and said that while she applauded also the way that Chrissy handled the situation, she felt that a lot of the media narrative kind of sought to minimize the impact of what Alison had said. And something I didn't realize until I researched further was the fact that she's had criticism leveled at her before for kind of taking a lot of the tenets of Asian and Middle Eastern cooking, not appropriately naming it. For example, she's apparently very famous for this stew, and the stew is essentially a curry in terms of all the ingredients, but she'll kind of refuse to call it a curry and just like doubles down and calls it a stew.
That's so weird.
Yeah, which I think if you are a white person, that wouldn't, the resonance of that wouldn't really impact you. But when you're a person who's come from a family that is Asian or Middle Eastern and who has come to a white country like Australia or America and been made fun of and mocked for the food that you eat because it's different to what your classmates eat, or you've had people making racial slurs that are based around your food, you'll see that it's like offensive to take the great parts about that cuisine and then kind of whitewash it to a really palatable middle class white audience. Like, it is quite gross. So then, yeah, I like ended up like getting on email with Crystal and like chatting to her more there. And then I asked her if she would mind coming on to chat about it in the podcast. And like we said before, we're very aware that the onus often falls back on people of color to explain to white people how they can do better. But she just had such a eloquent and amazing kind of perspective. So we really wanted to get her on to just chat to her about this in a bit more detail. Is that working?
Oh, I can hear you now. Can you hear me?
Yes. Yay. Right. That was me.
How are you?
Great. How are you?
Good. Quickly, just wanted to chat to you because you were so amazing and sent through such an amazing email to me and just kind of highlighted like a big blind spot that I think a lot of people have had, a lot of white people have had around the Alison Roman Chrissy Teigen situation. If you could just kind of summarize some of the things that you said to me.
Yeah, look, it's so interesting because even that little exchange, I think, you know, like I love you guys and what you do and listen to the episodes and think it's great. So it was so interesting to me to like come across the post in the feed, which was, yeah, as you say, it was a celebration of Chrissy Teigen's acceptance of, I suppose, her acceptance of Alison Roman's apology for comments that she'd made in an interview about Chrissy and Marie Kondo, and kind of saying, you know, you guys did raise such a valid point, which is like, we are so often really keen to get into the nitty gritty and the detail of two women having it out with each other and getting into a bit of a stoush in a very public way online, but then like not give them the praise when it is amicably resolved, which I do agree with. But it was crazy to me to see the language that was used around it, because it actually never occurred to me that it wasn't obvious that the comments Alison had made were kind of racial. So it was really illuminating to sort of see that the experience that I have, which is, wow, this is so clearly, I guess, sort of dragging women of color into something that's not necessarily about them, was not as obvious to everyone. Like, I was so, yeah, I was almost shocked, I guess, that it wasn't as apparent.
We obviously live in this culture that is like very quick to forgive white women and to give them the benefit of the doubt in a way that we aren't to people of color. So I think that the reaction that a lot of people had was like, oh, she's put a foot in her mouth, you know, and just because she might not necessarily have had nefarious intentions, like consciously, it doesn't mean that those weren't the intentions and connotations of what she was saying.
Yeah. So it's, you've really hit the nail on the head by sort of saying, you know, we kind of exist in a society that gives white people, but I suppose if we're going to really get down to it, white women the benefit of the doubt. And I think the one of the lines I sent you in the email was, you know, we don't ask them to explain the same sorts of things that white people ask people of color to explain. The interview with Alison that Alison Roman gave was fascinating to me because, I mean, she was talking about what she sees for her business and her career, which of course she's absolutely entitled to do. You know, it's her life. It seems like she has a pretty friendly relationship with the journalist who was writing up the piece for New Consumer. And in that interview, she talked about a potential TV show that's around, you know, her and her cooking that could be coming out. She talked about a collaboration she was doing with a cookware brand that would be coming out. And these are like kind of just normal things that we expect, so, you know, quote unquote, celebrity chefs to do and to talk about when they're spruiking their work. Like, it's all really par for the course. But then she kind of goes down this line of saying, you know, I don't want the big empire where it's like a full-on brand, a cookware brand that's all under my name and a content factory and all these different things. And the interview actually gave the example of Gwyneth Paltrow's Goop. It was like, oh, so, you know, you would never imagine something like Goop for yourself. And the crucial part there was that instead of saying, not that she should drag Gwyneth either, but instead of saying, no, you know, I'm not really interested in something like the Goop empire, she completely sidesteps the example of another white woman doing exactly what she's doing. And then instead hones in on two women of color who have not been referenced at all in the interview up until that point. It kind of came from out of nowhere. Criticizes Chrissy Teigen for having what she kind of deemed to be a content farm, which has since been proven to not be true, of people creating content for Cravings by Chrissy Teigen on her behalf. Judged Chrissy Teigen for having a cookware line with Target, and then for some reason brought Marie Kondo into it as well to kind of say, you know, she sold out by selling products with her name on it. The crazy thing is that in the same interview, Alison talks about, you know, having a cookware line coming out, albeit a small one, having a TV show coming out about her kind of career. Maybe that's a small one, maybe that's a big one, who knows? But the crux of all of that is what Alison as a white woman does, how she navigates those brand deals, how she navigates her own content empire in whatever way she deems to. She feels like she doesn't have to explain why that's of quality and why it's a good thing that she's allowed to do that. However, in the same breath, she then judges two women of color for doing the exact things that she's just told us that she's doing.
You also talked very eloquently about some of the phrasing that she used, like content farm and things like that, and how that has kind of problematic racial undertones, if you wouldn't mind just reiterating some of that.
This is where it kind of comes specifically in the realm of, we're not just talking about women of colour, but this kind of comes specifically into, I suppose, cultural implications for Asian people and Asian women. So some of the, I suppose, criticisms, if we want to kindly call them that, that Alison levelled at Chrissy Teigen, one of them around her having a content bump for her content. My take on that was that type of a, I don't want to use the word slur, that's the wrong word, that type of an insult to me had these really clear roots in the idea that Asian countries are responsible for pumping out really high volumes of low quality products. So that is really the underlying idea and judgment inherent in the concept of a sweatshop or, you know, massive manufacturing factories that we envisage when we think of production in China, when we think of, you know, production in Indonesia. What people are thinking about, I would say most of the time, is high quantity, low quality. So to phrase what Chrissy was doing is pumping out content from a content farm is sort of drawing on that very implication that she's pumping out lots of shit and she doesn't care for the quality of it. Which not only is, I mean, personally, I don't think that's true of Chrissy Teigen. To me, it really felt like it was drawing on a racial kind of prejudice. And then, you know, not, and that's not even touching the idea of, okay, it's one thing to judge, for example, China for manufacturing so much stuff, but then also not judge the predominantly white societies, countries, cultures that consume
they're making it all mainly for America, basically.
You know, who's buying it? Do we judge who's making it or who's buying it or both? So there was this, there was a level of playing off these ideas of racial stereotypes in her comments. And the thing is, whether she even realized that or not, like, I do think, and maybe this is my own internalized default to whiteness, right? But I don't know how intentional the comments she made in that interview were. It's systemic for her, probably, as it is for all of us. But I think the thing that a lot of people found so galling, particularly when it comes to the, you know, drawing on those very stereotypical ideas of Asian production, is that Alison's someone who has built a career, you know, in food and uses a lot of ingredients in her cooking and creates a lot of meals that draw from Asian food culture, a lot of ingredients that are heavily used in Asian cooking, and I would even say popularized by those kinds of meals. So it's kind of, it's a slap in the face for, on the one hand, her to be like, yeah, great, you know, I'm going to popularize the stew, which is basically a curry, but I'm not going to call it a curry, and then take these pot shots at Asian women who are also trying to find success in my industry. Like, that's just, you can't have it both ways.
You said something amazing on Instagram where I was like, only focusing on the women feminist side of it and not acknowledging the race side of it. And I was like, you know, society tells women that they should fight each other and whatnot. And you were like, yeah, but it's you can blame society only to a point, especially when you're a hugely public person who's making a living off having a huge platform. We can say, as maybe a reason for why people do things, that there's social structures of patriarchy or white supremacy that we're all trying to navigate, and it's all influencing how we think. But there has to be a level of responsibility when you hit a certain level of influence to start investigating and interrogating those things.
Yeah, 100%. Like, there has to be a level of personal responsibility, because then, you know, if there isn't, then we can excuse anything and everything by just saying, well, you know, society's evil and society made me do it. But we are all individual members who take part in society and make it what it is. So, you know, even like that night for me, I saw the post that you guys had put up there, and I really wrestled for a while with whether I should even say something about it, which again just goes to show how internalized it is, because I second guessed myself and I thought, oh, this doesn't sit right with me. I feel like it's minimizing an experience that I and others would have had reading Alison's comments. But maybe I shouldn't say anything, because maybe I'm bringing too much identity politics to it. Maybe I'm bringing race into it where that's not even an issue. Do I say anything? Is it easier just to let it go? And I'm so glad that I did, because I think, you know, if we can take the opportunities to have these conversations, except that we won't get them right all the time, but at least try and move forward a little bit, we're taking some ownership of the world that we create around us. Like, we can't just let it be what it is and not try to make things better, because what's the point, you know? I read a lot of Rachel Cargill. She's amazing in terms of unpacking white feminism, white fragility. I just think she's phenomenal and such an intelligent woman. She deals more specifically, she's American, African-American woman, and she deals kind of more specifically with the issues that African-Americans face in America and the world. But she has this great little tidbit or tip, I suppose, for white women, where you can kind of go, okay, how would I feel if this situation was happening, but it was a man instead sort of saying these things about women? Like, can we flip it that way and get a better understanding of what's actually going on here? Because it's not obvious. I think a lot of the time it's hard to not see things that you don't have lived experience of. It's hard to go down those layers of intersectionality, because there is kind of that hierarchy, you know. And I mean, as controversial as this might be to say, on the hierarchy, white women sit just below white men in terms of the power structure. So I guess it makes sense that, you know, you're not necessarily going to see things through the lens of a woman of color, or, you know, a queer woman, or, you know, all the other different ways that we can be kind of identified. So it's going to take some effort to stop yourself and then say, how could I see this through somebody else's lens?
Yeah, and I'm so happy that you did talk about it. But the thing that I guess we're aiming to get to in this podcast episode is the fact that it so often falls on people of color to come out and explain why something is offensive, or why something is oppressive or hasn't been taken seriously enough. And I can imagine that's a lot of emotional labor and can get very exhausting.
Yeah. I mean, look, it took a little time to write the email. because it is like, you know, it is work. And as much as I like kind of joke about it, I did have that thought too, where I was like, you know, okay, do I sit down and take some time to kind of explain how I felt and how I kind of see the structures of race working within this issue? Or do I kind of like leave it up to Grace and Izzy to kind of figure out for themselves and Google around? I guess at the end of the day, like, that is on each individual to kind of see what their level of comfort for that is. But you're so right. Like, you know, we have this amazing thing called Google, and so many perspectives are normally just a little search away. I think a really big part of the issue is having lots of different types of people in lots of different types of spaces, because the more diverse our teams, our working groups are, the more diverse guests we have on podcasts, the more diverse people we have within our communities, these things will just get honestly picked up naturally.
Yes. Most people, I think, if they like scratch beneath the surface, want a similar thing. It's just, you've just got to get through the weeds and like have a messy conversation sometimes, which is very important. But thank you again so, so, so much. I can't tell you how much we appreciate it.
Honestly, thank you so much for giving it the space, because I do like wholeheartedly think that conversations like this are just how it happens. It's the most enjoyable way of doing this kind of work. And I think it's honestly the most effective way of doing it as well. So that's like a nice little win-win. You know, we can have fantastic conversations and dismantle the fucking system all in one go.
So I think, I mean, obviously people who are probably listening want to know what they can do. And I think what you can do is really, like what you were saying earlier, examine the ways in your life, because everyone's lives are different. People might have more money than others and might be able to actually donate. Other people might have time and might be able to volunteer. You might only have time to really seek out a bunch of diverse humans who are telling different stories to yours and listening to them and reading up on them and you know, reading the books. You might, yeah, change your consumer habits so you are really focusing on what you're spending your money on. That's something that we do for sustainability anyway. And I feel like it's something that we should really do, to look at where your money's going at all times. And don't just kind of follow. I follow a lot of really amazing, we can put a lot of people in the show notes actually, but I follow a lot of really amazing activists who basically say, you don't want to be tokenism. You don't want to be the token person that people follow to make themselves feel better. It's actually about doing the work. Actually, I would love to play this little excerpt from, I mean, let's not break the, what is it, tradition now, from Billy Porter's interview with Jameela Jamil. And he's talking about something different, but it really hit home for me in the same sense, where he's basically saying that, He's so great. He's not humble at all. He's basically like, I fucking worked really hard to get where I am and I deserve every second of this. But basically Jameela was saying, you know, were you prepared, or how did you get your first job or whatever? And he just said, if you're not willing to put in the work, that's your own fault. And if you want to learn about something, and if you really, really want to do something, you can do it. You'll do it. Like, instead of just sitting around being like, I don't, like, literally, this is just, sorry to relate it back to us again, but I'm like, us last week were saying about our magazine jobs and how we got them and how you worked double shifts or like 20 hour days or whatever, and I moved countries within a minute's notice, and we worked really, really hard to get to where we were because we wanted it so badly, that then when people message us and just say, oh, how did you get your job, it's like, you just do the work if you really, really want to make a change. And I think that he kind of puts it so perfectly. And it's like, this is what we all need to be really doing if we actually want to help.
Whatever it is that you do, whoever it is that you are, do the work. If you want to be an actor, do the work. Make sure that you're in class. Make sure that you're auditioning. Make sure that you're reading plays. Make sure that you're going to the theater. Make sure the work. Y'all know what the work is. Mm-hmm. And if somebody has to tell you what the work is, then you don't want to do the work. You know what the work is. Anybody who wants to do anything knows exactly what the work is. And if you don't know what it is, find out. it's easy to find it out.
And it, yeah, it's just being more aware. And we're like learning at the exact same time as you guys. And that's why we wanted to talk about it. We're going to talk about it last week, but we pushed it out a week because we wanted to make sure we'd really read up on it, up on everything. But we want to learn with you. So if there's anything we've missed or if there's anything, any conversations to have, obviously we'd love to chat in the Facebook group as we always do after our episodes. We'd love to hear messages from anyone who may want to add to the conversation or may have think that we've missed points or has someone amazing that they think we should have on our radar. And also, I think as everyone who listens to the podcast again knows that we really want to use this little community we've created in this platform to obviously highlight amazing, incredible people. And that's why we started our After Work Drinks with Ciro. So you guys will be hearing from some really incredible, really diverse and really amazing people in the coming months.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for listening. We really, really appreciate it. We love you all very, very much.
Yep, we do. And let's all get reading or audiobook listening. Actually, why I'm no longer talking about People About Race, loved listening to it on an audiobook because Renny Edo Lodge reads it out. And I found it easier to get through it. Like, I ripped through it in 2 days. So I would highly recommend
She has a great voice.
She has a great voice. Yeah, she's amazing.
Yeah, and just read up. And you'll find that once you kind of like, the second you take the defensiveness out of it, you'll find that you're just absolutely enthralled and fascinated by everything that you're reading.
And angry, which is...
Yeah, and angry. But yeah, I think it's like this blocker that we all have. And like, it's actually quite easy to just take that out of the equation. And then suddenly you'll just be like a hoover, just sucking up all the knowledge you can.
Yeah. And I think it's important to stay angry how we are about sexism as well, because then it keeps it at the front of your mind.
Any system where like some people are fucking oppressed and some people are hugely privileged is just not good for humans, full stop. So like it's all the same goal that we're working towards. We just need to make sure we're working towards it for everyone and not just selectively picking people who look like us and then just working towards those people.
Exactly.
Nice. Okay, thanks guys. Rate, review and subscribe. Follow us on Instagram. What else? Tell your friends. Bye.
Tell your friends, tell your mom. Bye.
Bye.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.